I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jim Powers. My sobriety date is February 18, 2002. This is my home group, and I've been to more than one group conscious meeting, and that's it's not my night, so that's enough out of me. The group does ask me to remind you to please make sure your phones are off and refrain from moving around or talking while the speaker is sharing. And to introduce the speaker, when I came back from Georgia not quite a year ago, he became one of the first guys that I got to sit next to, got to meet. We started chairing meetings each week, one right after the other. He does Thursdays. I do Fridays at noon. And if you know noon, it's just like when you're up here, you get 1 to 2 minutes to qualify, and that's never enough time to hear somebody's story. And I've had a number of people come up and say that, you know, they'd sure like to know the rest of the story. So I'm just going to throw John to the wolves and have him come up right away. John?
Thank you. Thank you. I don't know how close to stand to this thing. Jim, I do appreciate it. Thank you for thinking of me. I think I realize that the Florida State Convention is going on right now, so you get what you get. All the good ones are up there in Jacksonville. Wow. Now, to say that I'm not nervous would be lying, and I'm a little bit nervous, but I think maybe once I get going, I am going to take a moment to ask my higher power to step in, so I'm just going to take a moment of silence, regroup, and get started. Again, my name is John. I am an alcoholic. And thrilled to be here. Very happy to be here. Happy to be sober. It's a wild ride. My sobriety date's June 18th of 2001. And that morning I was sitting outside of a treatment center in Columbus, Ohio, with two of my sisters, and they asked me if I wanted to pray about what was getting ready to happen. That was really the first time that I probably made a serious attempt at staying sober. I'll get to that in a minute. It's worked. With what they told me in the treatment center was to go to AA and listen to what y'all had to say. So when I got out of that treatment center and got back here home, I started going to AA meetings on a regular basis and got a sponsor and worked the steps. But getting there, I'm supposed to tell you a little bit about my experience, strength and hope, and what it took to get here. I was born and raised in Columbus, Ohio, the youngest of six children. My mom and dad were married until my mom passed away about 15 years ago. It's a very, I would say, as normal as family as you can get, somewhere between, I don't know, the Cleavers and the Adams family. Probably leaning a little closer to the Adams family, but we had a wonderful family. I have four sisters and a brother, and the way it worked out, I had three sisters right in front of me, so I didn't get too many hand-me-downs. And the sisters that were right in front of me, they didn't like it because they had three generations of hand-me-downs, and I was always getting the new stuff. My dad was just a hard factory-working guy. We went to Presbyterian Church most of my entire childhood, and Vacation Bible School and tent camp in this huge tent that held all eight of us. And it seemed to rain 4 out of 7 days every time you went camping. And we dug those trenches and tried to keep the water out of the tent. And just a real, real, what I thought was probably a normal childhood. I had a sister got married, and there was no alcohol at the reception or anything. My brother got married. There was no alcohol at the reception. Family reunions, there was no alcohol. There was no alcohol in my, I couldn't blame that. I come in here and I hear all that, and I can't blame it on my parents. I can't, my alcoholism is all mine. I get to lay claim to that. And, again, it was an extremely, normal childhood. I think when it all started kicking in, and I've shared this a little bit in here, we didn't move until my ninth grade in school, which was my last year of junior high finished at ninth grade. And we moved just before I went into the ninth grade, so I had to go to this school that I felt like everybody knew everyone. They had all been together for the last 2 years, if not 9 years. And that whole year, that might have been the most miserable year of my life. I hated school. I hated the kids that were there. I didn't make any friends. And then it went into summertime. And again, I was like, for that year or so, I had my parents dragging me back and forth to the old neighborhood to play hockey and stuff with the kids that I grew up with. So I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, there's just a lot of fear in there. This is just a scared child, just scared to death of my shadow, of life, of meeting people. I did not know how to make friends. And it hit me. It hit me right then. It was the summer. Backing up just a little bit, I did have some neighbors that moved in next door to us, and they built this huge five-car garage, and they built race cars, and they raced them at the dirt tracks on the weekends. And this huge garage only had two small windows up on the second floor. Everything else was steel doors and steel garage doors. You couldn't see in there. And me and the neighbors, one of them was, they were a year apart in age, and I was right in the middle. So three guys all within 1 year or 2 years of each other. And we finally, one night, I know we figured out that I'm probably 8 or 9 years old now, and we've got a ladder, and we climbed up to look in this garage to see what they're doing, because we don't think they're building race cars all the time, not at 10 o'clock at night, you know, and they're drinking their beer and watching movies and stuff like that. And figured out that they had some beer in there, and we got our hands on some beers. But I had that beer, and I didn't like it. I don't even think we finished, between the three of us, I don't think we finished two beers. And that was the last time I had any beer for a few more years. We ended up at this new house, and like I said, we'd been there probably a year or so, all the way through ninth grade and into the summer. I'm getting ready to go into high school. I still have very few friends. My mom had gotten tired of taking me back to the old neighborhood, and she had realized that when she drove down the street and turned the corner to come onto our street, that there was this large house on the right-hand side that must have had at least 8 or 10 guys coming in and out. Always traffic, always guys going in and out, from younger than me to older than me. She said, why don't you go down there? Can everyone hear? She said, why don't you go down there and just see who lives there and introduce yourselves, and you know, something will happen with that. And I'm like, okay, you know, this is little Johnny. He's got to walk down the street and knock on his door and say, hi, I'm Johnny. I'm new in the neighborhood. And I'm not really new. I've been there a year or so. I'm not doing this, you know. I'm 13 years old. I'm not knocking on any door trying to introduce myself. But I'd left the house and told her that's what I would do. And I walked down there and I turned the corner and I'm right in front of their house. But I noticed in front of me in the schoolyard is a very large tree with a very large tree fort in it. And I said, well, I'm just going to go up in the street for it and kill some time while I'm supposed to be down here introducing myself. And I got about halfway up that tree, and a half a dozen kids came out of that house screaming profanities and promising to kick my butt if I didn't get out of their tree fort, that same house that I was supposed to go knock on the door. And I'm scared to death, and I'm trying to get out of this tree as fast as I can. And one of the guys goes, hey, aren't you that kid that's playing roller hockey down there in the church parking lot all by yourself all the time? And I said, yeah, that's me. Well, what are you doing now? Well, I was just going to check out the tree fort. We were just going up. You want to come up? We're going to have some beers and get high. Sure. No problem. Okay? And we went up there, and we had a few beers and smoked some pot, and I was in heaven. I had five of my best friends all of a sudden. And it did turn out that there were 10 boys in this family and one girl. And Dad drove a beer truck. And so their basement was full of beer. And they were Irish Catholic. But most of them were now going to go to the public school. And Victor, who was my age, was going to go to the public school for the first time with me. So we made friends the rest of that summer and got real used to the tree fort, and got used to drinking beer without throwing up. And in fact, the first day of high school, me and my best friend shared an 8-pack of Little Kings before school. And I think that set the tone, because then, I mean, that's how I was for the next 3 years. I just had this little buzz on, and nobody seemed to notice it, because that's just how I was. And for 3 years, all through high school, it was really just during high school. It was weekends. It was football games and parties all through high school. I managed to get okay grades and got out of high school. I think then, when you're not doing real good, they put you in work programs. So, for the 12th grade, I only went to school for two periods and then went to work. Maybe to keep me from failing, that might have been what it was. But at any rate, I graduated on time, and Victor graduated on time. And we both were still 17. And Victor's older brother worked on the Delta Queen steamboat going up and down the Mississippi and Ohio rivers, and he said he could get us jobs. But we had to wait till we were 18, which was about a month and a half from the time we graduated. I turned 18, and 3 weeks later, Victor turned 18, and we drove down to Cincinnati and filled out the paperwork. And within 2 weeks, we both got phone calls saying they were flying us out to St. Louis, that we had jobs. And they flew us out to St. Louis. I was 18 years old, flying me out to St. Louis. We got on the boat, and the first trip on the boat was from St. Louis up to Minneapolis-St. Paul. And that was a 14-day trip. They fed us on the boat. You lived on the boat, all that stuff. But I was a busboy. I didn't see any money that whole time. But when the passengers got off, they gave us these little yellow envelopes, and all of a sudden, I had a whole bunch of money in my pocket. We were in Minneapolis, and Victor had made a lot of money because he was a porter doing the luggage deal, so he had a lot of cash on him. And we went into downtown Minneapolis, and the first pub we came to was an Irish pub. It was a Friday morning in downtown Minneapolis, and we found an Irish pub that was open. It wasn't noon yet, but we found this Irish pub, and we weren't sure what the age limit was in the state of Minnesota at the time, but we tried to order some beers anyways, and we got served beers, and this was cool. We're on the road, a lot of money in our pockets, and we're getting served beer, legally, I think. You know, I'm not sure. But we had a couple of beers, and then we had some Irish whiskey, and then the bartender said that we should probably go. And Victor played football. He was a pretty big guy, and he didn't like the fact that the bartender said we should go, but he convinced us that we should go, and we left. And I hit the bright sunlight of Minneapolis in the summertime on a Friday afternoon, and drunker than a skunk. Victor carries me back to the boat. And almost every city that boat pulled into, you had to go down a hill to get to the river. I guess that's just laws of gravity, the river on a hill. Anyway, in Minneapolis, it's cement and concrete and everything, and I managed to fall down those steps, and Victor carried me onto the boat, and I proceeded to throw up all over the luggage that was on the bow of the Delta Queen. Now, I'm not sure if that was incoming passengers or passengers that was leaving. I, to this day, I don't know, but Victor got me to my room, and I passed out, and I missed the sailing buffet. As a busboy, I missed the sailing buffet, and I woke up about 3 o'clock in the morning fearing for my job. So I went up, and I did all the work that all three busboys did. I set the entire dining room up and prepped all the lemons and the coffee and everything for breakfast the next day. And they get up, and, you know, the busboys get up at 5 o'clock when they're supposed to or whatever, and everything's done. And I talked to the maitre d'. I'm pretty sure I'm going to lose my job. And he says, don't worry about it, John. It happens to everybody once, okay? You get one break, and that was it, okay? So don't let it happen again. I worked on that boat for about a year and a half. And by the time I got off that boat, I was drinking hard liquor, and it didn't matter what time of day it was. When the boat would pull into any port, it seemed like those of us that worked on it were knocking the passengers out of the way to get off first, to make it to the closest saloon, to shoot pool, or to go to the package store. And we were the last ones back on the boat. You know, the whistle's blowing, they're pulling up the gangplank, and we're running with our packages and our bottles and everything to get back on the boat. A lot of shooting dice and gambling and everything. And that was very exciting for this 18-year-old, 19 years old, turned 19 while I was on the boat. But that alcoholism, and that part of Bill's story, I had arrived, you know, and that's where I am in his story at this point in my life. I'm just, I've hit the big times. I'm making money. I'm traveling the United States, and life is good. And I'm drinking, and I'm drinking pretty heavily already. As I said, I worked on the boat for about a year and a half, and got off that boat, and a friend from high school, a high school sweetheart, had moved to Florida in the meantime. So I packed up a 63 Bel Air and drove it down here to Jacksonville and lived in Jacksonville for about 3 years, where I think my drinking tapered off a little bit. I had a front desk job, and but it was there. It was still, the partying was going on, and I was already blacking out. You know, my drinking, my blackout drinking started right away, and it continued throughout all of my drinking. I drank to get drunk, and the blackout drinking was going on. I ended up down here in Orlando in 83, and I got a job over at a nice hotel in the Disney area, and started there as a server. And within about 3 years, I was a bartender and then a beverage captain. And as a beverage captain, I loved my job. My job was, my office was about half the size of this room, and it was a small ABC store. And by this time in my drinking, I'm about 35 minutes away from work, and it's at least two tall boys going to work. I'm drinking before work, at work, and then really partying after work. It's an almost around the clock deal by then. But I'm getting promoted at work, and life is good. Buying a house here, and things are good. Somewhere along the line, while I had a job for almost 15 years, and I was questioned towards the end about my drinking and how much I was drinking, and they thought maybe I was drinking a little too much, and I couldn't understand that because I was drinking with the same people that were questioning me. In the hospitality business, you do a lot of drinking with your coworkers, even if they're your superiors. That's just the way it was at this place, anyway. So it felt kind of strange that they would question me on this. And in fact, one day they decided to ship me off to go pee in a cup to make sure I wasn't drinking on the job. And I'm okay, I'm done. You know, I'm thinking I got a 3-day vacation. They get the results back, and I'll be out of job. And it came back negative. So I'm like, okay. That's cool. It works for me. And so I had that job for maybe another year. And then they just said that. Actually, it wasn't even quite a year. It was when another company bought them, and they decided that since I was on probation, even though it came back negative, that they were going to let me go. And that was a blow to everything, because by that time I had married, and I had a couple of children. And doing the math, it's just amazing. I'm sitting here and I'm trying to figure out. Married 17 years, sober 8 years. So there was a lot of, I mean, those last 8 years of my drinking were, you know, with this lady here, my lovely wife here, that we managed to get through that I got put up with the last 8 years of somebody's drinking and stick it out. You know, that's a God thing, I do believe. And then to have the 8 years of sobriety going on now, it's just cool. But I lost that job then, and I didn't have any real good employment up until that was like 98. And I do remember trying to do my taxes in 2000, and I had like 7 W-2 forms, and 3 of them, it took me a long time to figure out where they were from. And one I still don't know where it is, and it was only about 6 months ago. But this stuff bothers me when I could not figure it out. One, I realized it was Dubs Dread. I worked over at Dubs Dread Golf Course for about a week, and after a hard night at work, I thought an Absolute on the rocks would be perfect. And the bartender had already left, and so you know I figured I'll just fix my own. I don't want to bother anybody, and. So I made this huge Absolute on the rocks and had it, and the manager asked me if I'd had an Absolute on the rocks. I said, yeah. And that's why you no longer work here. They frowned on that. But that was like one of the last, that was probably one of the last jobs I had. And things were getting, you know, in Bill's story, things were getting bad now. I'd already had a few DUIs a couple of DUIs, and then the third one, I was sitting in my driveway when the police officer felt like I should still go to jail. And but I'd made it home, I had a very short trip from the bar to the house, and when she turned on her lights, I pulled in my driveway, and so I really thought she was going to let me go. She didn't not only not let me go, she didn't let me tell them that I was going to jail. And I had to say, well, they're going to wake up and find my truck in the driveway and me not here. Come on, you got to at least knock on the door and tell them that I'm gone. I don't know if she did or not, but I think she might have. But so my last DUI, I was actually sitting at home. But that was the one that got me 31 days down at 33rd Street. And you would think that that might do it. But I ended up working in the laundry the last few weeks of that, or the last couple of weeks of that. So I got out for good behavior and working there, and I didn't have a ride home. I didn't think I was getting out. But they gave me the money back that I went in with, and so I went right across the street to that racetrack that's over there and got a tall boy and almost got busted for open container. But managed to avoid that, and I got a ride home, and the drinking resumed like nothing had happened. While all that's going on, I was our son, who's the youngest one, who's 12 now, was around 3 or 4, and I was taking him to preschool, and I was taking him on a regular basis, and the folks at preschool didn't like the fact that they smelled alcohol on my breath at 9 o'clock in the morning when I was bringing my son to preschool, and they got Family and Children's Services involved, and when Family and Children's Services arrived at the house around noon, there was already a small pile of beer cans, and they didn't like that, and they thought that Kyle, my son, had too many bruises, and the bruises were just being a four-year-old boy, but they wanted to take him anyways. And this one remembers, I mean, Amanda had to remind me of this one, because they took my son, and I didn't even argue. I didn't argue with them. My wife was at work. They say we need to take him for observations and look at him, and in the meantime, you need to stop drinking for 24 hours, and then we're going to test you. You know, and by this time, I couldn't stop drinking for 24 hours by this time. You know, to try and work an eight-hour shift was just forget it. You know, there was no way I was working an eight-hour shift. If I didn't have a job where I could make it out to the truck and have, you know, at least a few shots or a slug down the tall boy or something like that, it wasn't going to work. So all of these things were going on while this alcoholism is progressing. And my last real job was down at a hotel very close to the house, and I was trying. I was trying real hard not to drink, and I just couldn't do it. I would just try and get so drunk the night before that I'd just be hungover. Let me just be hungover for 6 hours or 8 hours, and then I physically could not do the eight-hour deal. You know, it was it's just like his story. You know, three or four beers first thing in the morning just to be able to eat anything, or when the shakes and the sweat started kicking in, it was time for a drink. I didn't care where it was. I didn't care what I was doing. Quick story, I will get into the recovery part of this, and that's going pretty good. I got a little bit of time for that too. When my daughter was born, my wife had the suitcase all packed, nice and neat, and everything that you women need to take to the hospital for having a baby and stuff. And I got home from work, and actually, I guess we went to bed. I'm probably drunk. I'm sure I am, but we go to bed, and she has contractions all night long, and in the morning, it must be about 4:30 or 5 o'clock, she says it's probably time to go because they're about 5 minutes apart already. And when she stood up, they went from 5 to 3. So we took the suitcase and threw it in the truck and dropped off our oldest one at his grandparents' house and headed to the hospital. And within an hour, this one's here, and no time for epidurals or nothing like that. And we have this beautiful baby by 7 o'clock in the morning. And I don't have my liquor, I don't have my booze, and I'm looking through her suitcase. I'm trying to figure out what she forgot. You know, she had to have forgot something because I need to go home and get whatever it is that you forgot. I need to get out of this hospital room. This is a beautiful baby, but my hands are starting to sweat and I'm starting to shake, and I need a drink. And I wasn't there very long, and I did. I had to leave, and I had to get home because it was too early. I had something at home. I went home and got my liquor, and I was fine, and I went back to the hospital and enjoyed my baby. I was like, "Ooh, this is, you know, now this is cool. Now this is okay." You know, but it took me places. You know, it takes us places and it has us doing things that we really, you know, we don't want to do. Anyways, I was by now I'm unemployable. I can't keep a job. Some old friends that we had gotten out of touch with each other. That sort of happens in our last stages of drinking, I think. Well, any of our, even our good friends or whoever we thought were good friends and longtime friends are not in the picture anymore. But I think one of them realized how bad things were getting, and they called my family at home up in Columbus, and they got a hold of a sister of mine and explained to her how it really was down here, because I had never really told them the whole truth or anything close to the truth. But this friend told them how bad it was really getting, and that I was unemployable and drinking around the clock and was probably going to lose everything. And my family, my sisters got together, my brother got together, and they talked about it, and they decided that maybe we can fly him home, you know, and let's look for a treatment center or something like that. So my sister Joanne got online and found a treatment center up there in Columbus, Ohio, and they pitched in, and they had enough money for an airline ticket. And I got a phone call from Joanne, and I'll never forget. I was sitting on our kitchen floor, on the cold tile floor, and she's telling me that she's heard about what's going on and how bad it's getting, and that her and the rest of her sisters and my brother have pitched in, and they got this ticket for me, and they found a treatment center for me if I'm willing to accept help, which I believe anybody, that's like our third step of the program. Was I willing to accept help? It was there for me. She was offering it to me. And this is like sort of the beginning of God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I don't know where it came from. Sort of like when Jim asked me to speak. You know, I don't know where it came from, but I said, you know, yeah. Yeah, I'll take this help. And I told her that I would come up there. I would do anything. I didn't have anything left to fight with. I had no ammo. I had no job. I knew we were going to lose the house and the kids were probably going to get taken away. I was out of, you know, butts. You know, I was out of everything. And I was willing to go up there. So probably within a couple of days, I was on an airplane headed up there, and I'm pretty sure it was like a Thursday. And when I got there, the bed wasn't there at this treatment center. And I thought for sure I was going right into a treatment center. I mean, I got real good and drunk on that plane on the way up there, and I was going home to get sober, so she's already going to be, you know, they're already going to be pissed off that I'm getting there drunk, and they're not going to let me have anything. But when this bed wasn't available, I tried to explain to my sister that, you know, I'm going to go into the DTs, and it's going to get scary, and I can die from these things if you don't let me drink. And she didn't know what I was talking about. She had no clue what I was talking about. And I had to convince her to call this treatment center and ask them, you know, to explain it to them. And she did, and they did tell her, said, yeah, listen, if you try and cut him off cold turkey, you're going to be taking him to the emergency room within an hour if he's drinking the way he says he's drinking. And so they got me a suitcase of beer, and me and my brother-in-law sat out on the back porch and probably had half of that. And then the next morning I finished it off, and the room wasn't available again. And that went on for 2 days. And Monday morning I told her, I said, listen, I can drink a suitcase a day at home. You know, that's what I was doing before I came up here. You know, I'm either going to get in this treatment center or I'm going to go home. You know, because I had my family and everything down here. I'm sure I could get a job, you know. There's no problem getting a job and making a living again. You know, I can do this. But and I'm quite sure that he up there knew that I was about ready to come home. And so that bed became available that day. And I we went into that. We drove over there. My sister grabbed another sister. So two of my sisters and I headed towards this treatment center. And we got there and we sat out there in the parking lot. And they asked me, do you want to pray about this? And I said, yeah, I think I need all the help I can get, so, you know, let's invite him into the equation and see how it goes. And so we said a short prayer out there in the parking lot, and I'd already had like 4 or 5 beers that morning. And we walked into the treatment center, and one of the nurses or whoever greets you at the door or whatever took one look at me and goes, man, you need to sit down. You know? I said, no, I'm going to be fine, you know. I have nothing, you know, I've only had 3 or 4 beers. I'm okay, you know, and I really thought I was. But anyways, that was June 18th of 2001. I went into that treatment center, and I was really nervous about DTs because I'd suffered through them at 33rd Street. I think the only thing they'd let you do is not die. You know, they don't really help you with the DTs, but they make sure they don't really like people dying in there. So at any rate, I was afraid of the DTs. I was afraid of sobering up from just the physical withdrawal of alcohol. And at this place, none of that happened. They just had me on whatever it was. It was nice. But I was only on it for a day and a half. And then one of the counselors said that, you know, we took you off everything yesterday. And this is what's left of 25 years of serious drinking. And I was just, so I'm not on anything anymore. And I wasn't throwing up You know, a lot of us, or I did anyways, when I didn't get enough, it seemed like that's when I threw up. You know, when I had plenty to drink, I didn't throw up. But when I was out of it, that's when I was getting really sick to my stomach and feeling bad. But it was done. I mean, I had the alcohol out of my system, and they said, you know, we barely even gave you anything to sleep on last night, and tonight you can try not sleep. I mean, nothing, and just try sleeping on your own too. And I said, okay, well, I'll try and see if it, you know, if it works, it works, and if it doesn't, because I don't know about any of you, but I never fell asleep. I passed out, and to just sleep, you know, to just sleep on my own was a beautiful thing. And that night I went to sleep, and I don't know, it was pretty cool. And so I was excited. I was excited to have alcohol out of my system. I was thrilled to death. But a really big counselor there told me, and I was only there 14 days. 7 days I didn't get to leave. In the last 7 days, it was only 8 to 5, and I was able to go home to my father's house. They said I need to go to an AA meeting when I went to my father's house and talk about it the next day during treatment. And so I agreed to do that, and I started doing that. And that was really, I think, the first time I heard anybody laugh in an AA meeting. A guy said, you know, this is a very confusing program because we're supposed to, you know, it's all about selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of the problem, and we need to get out of that. Yet this guy asked me to come up here and talk about myself for 45 minutes. And I was like, yeah, that doesn't make any sense either, you know. So, but it, you know, that meeting and the few meetings up there that I started going to, I started connecting with you folks. I started connecting with people that were as sick as me, but they weren't hurting anymore. And I ended up getting back here. And I started going to a meeting on a regular basis over on the east side of town. And I got me a job. And I realized that that job wasn't going to fix everything that I had destroyed in all the drinking. And that job wasn't paying the bills. So I got two jobs. And I had a job over at Walmart working 40 hours a week. And I was working at the UCF 40 hours a week. And that was still barely making it, and I was 5 months, 4 or 5 months back on the mortgage, and they didn't want to hear anything about partial payments. And these same people, that guy that invited me into the tree fort, he is still a good friend, and his wife was getting ready to buy a car, but she had changed her mind. I don't know, women do that once in a while, but she had the money to buy the car. I mean, she had withdrawn the money to buy the car and then changed her mind, and she goes, you know, if you need any of this money right now to get back on your feet, I have it for you. And I said, well, yeah, I'm trying to work two jobs, but this mortgage company wants, you know, a whole bunch of money in one lump sum, and I don't know how I'm going to do it. She goes, well, it'll be there in 2 days. And it was there. And I paid the mortgage people off and got back to sort of like square one. That's that step two that's not up there, you know, that $2,000 loan that Sandy Beach always talks about. You know, there was no step that had $2,000 in it, but that's what I, you know, that was one of those things that I thought I needed. Really what I needed was just to not drink and trust this program. And that's what I started doing, and things started happening. I mean, good things started happening. I was staying out of jail, and I was able to keep my job there at Walmart for a while. I was there for 5 years or so, got promoted and everything. And it's funny, I was doing evening meetings early in sobriety, and and actually it was the first 90 days, so real early in sobriety. And they called me and wanted me to work. And I was about 60 days into my 90 days. And I was like, shoot, man. I couldn't look at her until I turned down work. So I went to work. And the next day I went into the meeting and said, listen, I had to work last night, so I didn't do my 90 and 90, but I'm going to do two meetings today. Does that count? Can I do my 90 and 90 by making two today? And they chuckled a little bit and just said, start over if you want to. I don't know if I've ever done 90 and 90, but I try to do like 5 or 6 a week, 7 a week, 8 a week if I can. I love this stuff. You know, it's good stuff. That the group that I was at early on, really, we read out of the big book on Fridays and we read out of the 12 and 12 on Tuesdays. And I think that was the key, or is part of the key to this whole deal, is that program that's outlined in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It hadn't changed ever since they wrote that book back when they wrote it. And it's real clear-cut directions on how to get sober. And, you know, if you're new in this stuff, and I was really hoping that when Jim asked that, there would be a few new people in here so I could tell you what you need to do in the beginning, you know. But, you know, at any rate, you can keep on doing it, you know. And that's what started working. And like I said, I went to those meetings on a regular basis, and but I tell you, when my schedule changed and I started coming over here to Central, there are good meetings and there are great meetings and there are, you know, AA meetings. And I do believe it's what we bring to the meeting. That if I walk out of a meeting thinking it was a bad meeting, that's on me. That is really on me. But this one here, at least at the noon, we really work on the solution, and our topics come right out of the book. And there's a speaker out there who reminded me that I'm not the only one who went to a meeting for a while, and some of those poor me meetings that you're halfway through and you just want to blow your head off, you know, and those are dangerous, you know. But we have the opportunity to change that. You know, we can change that when it's our turn to share, we don't jump into that same old, you know. I got to, at Walmart, I got to where I couldn't even take that break with those people, because 15-minute breaks in the break room where all they're doing is complaining. And I'm the happiest guy on earth right now because I got about a year and a half sober. I don't know what these people are complaining about, but I got this stuff that's working. You know, why don't you come with me? And then whether you got a drinking problem or not, you work this program, and life will turn around. It's good stuff. So I got that sponsor, and that's the one thing that, you know, I was supposed to share my experience, strength, and hope, and that's one that I kind of try and stay away from as much as possible, because my sponsor, he told me, listen, and I watched him, and I picked the guy who was at a meeting every day, and he was eating his lunch during, you know, the noon meeting at this place, but he was on his lunch break, and he was going to a meeting, and what he was sharing was good stuff. So I asked him to be my sponsor, and he said, sure, and we went out back there, and we done the first three steps, and, you know, in about 45 minutes or an hour, and he had heard me share for a little while. You know, I remember probably a couple years sober, I said I didn't say anything that first year. If anybody knows Alcohol Jim from the East Side Club, he said, bullshit, you know, you ran your mouth like anybody else for, you know, like a newcomer would. And but I didn't think I said anything. Anyways, this sponsor, we did the first three steps out back, and he wanted me to get started on that fourth step, and I procrastinated. About 3 months later, he asked me if I'd started on it, and I hadn't started on it. But I was going to meetings every day. I was still going to meetings every day. So he's like, well, as long as you're going to meetings every day, but you know, if you want this stuff to really kick in, you need to do the steps. You need to work the steps. And probably 8 months into it, I did that fourth step, and then we did the fifth step, and I shared about just the other day. Man, big stuff starts happening when you work with other people and you throw that stuff out on the table and you get the weight of the world off your shoulders, and you can say, man, I'm okay, you know. I done some stuff, and I did some bad stuff. But thank goodness there's some steps in there that we can work, you know, we can work and clean all that up. And you work all those steps, and then you start working with others. Now, this is some really, really cool stuff. But back to my sponsor, he told me, he said, listen, you call me when you feel like drinking, you know. I didn't call him. I didn't call him for like a year. And we ran into each other. This is after he had moved away. He got a different job, so we weren't going to the same meeting. And we'd already done the fifth step, and we were working. I showed him my eighth step. So actually, I showed him my amends list. And he recommended a couple of them that I should probably, you know, might not want to do that right now. You know, give sobriety a little more time, and we'll take a look at that. But it's, you know, it's a good list, and get started on it. And like most good alcoholics, I had already scratched 4 or 5 or 25 off before I ran that by my sponsor. And so how'd that work out? And it's okay. Yeah, I'll go back and make another one. But he said, you know, well, I didn't mean that's the only time you had to call me was when you felt like drinking. Because that's what he told me. He said, when you feel like drinking, you call me. And after a year and I didn't see him and I didn't call him, and when we ran into each other, he said, why didn't you call me? Well, I haven't felt like drinking. Jeez, you dumb shit. You don't have to wait till you feel like drinking. Well, I'm slow, you know. I don't know. You know, it took me a year and a half to do the steps, and by the grace of God, I didn't drink during that time. And I really wasn't, you know, this dry drunk thing that people talk about. I don't understand that. I really don't. I don't want to ever understand it. And I've been told that by continuing to work the steps and to practice these principles and all our affairs, I don't know that. You know, I don't think I have to. I don't think I have to know what a dry drunk feels like, and I don't want to. And there's a lady over here. Said, you know, this isn't one day at a time program, but if I do what I'm supposed to do, I can stay sober the rest of my life. And that really bothered me in the beginning because they said, you can't look into the future. You know, You don't have to worry about looking into the future. I said, well, what about vacations and stuff like that, planning for retirement? You know, this one day at a time, right here, right now, is confusing me. You know, just like you got to give it away to keep it stuff. There's a lot of things that are confusing in here. That book was confusing. And somebody in a meeting maybe a year or so ago said, it was a very confusing book, but today it sounds like poetry. And that book, I can pick it up in any page through 164, open it up and start reading it and just get goosebumps and fall in love with whatever it's got to say and understand that I'm okay and I'm safe. If I do what those first 164 pages asked me to do, if I do that on a regular basis, you know, I really like what I have right now. It's not whatever it is, that phrase that, you know, I don't even know it right now, but I know I'm happy with what I got right now. And if I'm okay with that, you know, life can be, you know, life is good. Life is real good. My year is almost up for chairing the meetings, and it's just an exciting time around here. And I know something else will come up, and that's why I was getting ready to talk about the future. You know, I think as long as I'm here in Central Florida, the Central Group will be my home group. And the noon meeting, unless my schedule changes, which, you know, hopefully it will, probably it will, you know, in some way or another. I know it's going to change, whether it's good or bad. That's a decision I think I get to make, you know, whether I think it's bad stuff or good stuff. That's all in my attitude about what happens. But as long as I'm around, there's a bus route right there if I have to. And there was a friend who's out in Alabama now. He's like, you know, if you're really solid in this stuff, you know, you can lose your house. You can lose your job. There's people in these rooms that have lost everything, but they still got it here. They still got it here, and they can still be happy. You know. And on the other hand, that bottom that different people have to hit, you can be homeless under the bridge and not hit that bottom yet. That bottom's all different, too. And, you know, my bottom was my bottom. I think it would have been enough to scare the hell out of a lot of other people, but, you know, apparently it was just right for me, and to be able to live through what I lived through, it's just a really, really cool thing. And that's where that spiritual growth comes in. I know I'm, like, freaking out my daughter a little bit, which actually she'll probably think that she brought me on board, because I'm very quiet about the whole deal. It's sort of like politics. I don't like to talk about it. And our tradition that says it's based on attraction, and I got one quick story, and then I'm going to wrap it up because I don't know what time I'm supposed to be done. But it's based on attraction rather than promotion. Forgive me if my math is not good, and I tell this story a couple times, but I was probably about 4 or 5 months sober, maybe even a little bit more than that sober. And Kyle, the youngest one, was sitting at home having a bowl of cereal, and I just made him a bowl of cereal, full to the top with milk and cereal, and just full. And he didn't get one bite out of it and spilled that bowl of cereal. And he's 4.5 years old at this time, and I'm newly sober, and the look of fear on this child's face was just, I mean, you would have thought he was going to die. And those bruises that I talked about earlier, they weren't from me. They were just from being, a 4-year-old boy. But the look that he gave me was like, oh, my, you know, I'm in big trouble now. And all I did was get a towel, and we cleaned that up, and we made another bowl of cereal. And then the love that came over his face was like, wow, who is this guy? Where'd you come from? Yeah, and where's my dad? But, you know, and I think there were some other people that might have witnessed that, you know, going on, that whole deal going on. And what we get to do is just practice these principles in all our affairs. And we're going to touch a lot of, I think we're going to touch a lot of people out there that may like what they see or may want what they see and try this stuff out. But as for going out there and trying to recruit them, I don't do a very good job of that. But if just doing the next right thing in these rooms and out there in that world helps, then that's, you know, that's what I plan on keep on doing. I'm going to wrap it up with that. I do appreciate y'all. That was the other thing. I think somebody, I heard a speaker say that this whole deal was supposed to be, I'm supposed to talk and you're supposed to listen, and if we both get done at the same time, it worked out okay. So,
thank you.
Thanks, John.